Welcome back, my fellow peanuts, and thank you for joining my bonus episode. Happy Halloween. Now, as I said on my last podcast, I'm running a competition to see if you know what's different today. Whoever answers correctly in the comments below will get a prize, and I'll announce the winner on my next episode, which would be November the 10th. Now, guys, there's two things that are different today. Whichever one of those you do pick up on, I'll still consider that the answer. Okay? So this podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic and violent content. Listener discretion is advised. Now, I've been hinting away at what we're going to be talking about today, but I'm really excited to say we're going to be talking about the murder of Martha Moxley. Now, a lovely 15-year-old by the name of Martha Moxley would become a worldwide name for all the wrong reasons. Murder, Halloween, and the Skakel family would never be the same in a small town in Connecticut. Now, the Moxley family had actually moved to the exclusive gated community, Bellhaven in Greenwich, just over a year before Martha was murdered. Now, they had moved to this particular area for its safety because it was quite exclusive. It had people like the Skakels, who are related to the Kennedys, Diana Ross, and a mogul by the name of Paul Tudor Jones. So who wouldn't want to live there with that kind of exclusive, you know, community? Now, on October 30th in 1975, a night which is known as Mischief Night, a night of fun for teenagers. So jokes, pranks, and/or parties, things like toilet paper in houses. Sounds like some fun to me. I kind of wish we'd had something like that here growing up, but obviously we didn't in Australia. Now, unfortunately for Martha, though, this night would actually end in her death. After Martha and her friends had some fun, and very, very harmless fun, I might add, they would stop by the Skakel house. Now, this family was well known around the neighbourhood for their behaviour, parties, and a real lack of discipline. They also happened to be related to Ethel Skakel Kennedy, who just happened to be the wife of the late Robert Kennedy. Yep, Bobby Kennedy himself. Now, Martha would hang out with her friends as well as two of the Skakel brothers, Tommy and Michael. They would just be listening to music in a car, just having some fun and just being normal teenagers. Now, Martha would be described as beautiful, easygoing, and everyone who met her just wanted to be her friend. I've met people like this, and it's just really hard not to want to be their friend and adore them. So I think Martha would have been a really good person to meet. It would take over 25 years for someone to be convicted of the murder, and there are so many twists and turns in this story, guys. There's still a huge amount of doubt and uncertainty as to who the killer is. I certainly have a theory that I'm willing to share with you guys, but just be aware that this is just a theory of mine and I've got no evidence to claim it as true or to back it up. Now, this podcast today will be telling you about those twists and turns, and I have to say, I'm not sure we're ever really going to know what happened on this fateful night. It's just too many lies, speculation, and just not enough, right, to just have a proper answer. So Martha's curfew that night was 10 p.m. Now, this is where things are not really confirmed, okay? But supposedly after spending some time with Tommy, one of the Skakel brothers, and making out and just having some teenage fun with a boy, it's said that she was last seen behind the fence of the Skakel house, that she was last seen. The last time her friends genuinely saw her was near, like, the driveway of the Skakels. So this would actually never be proven to be accurate, as no one could really verify whether they'd seen her run off with Tommy. When Martha didn't make it home by her curfew, which was really unusual for her, she was a really good girl. She rarely broke the rules. So her mother became quite worried and she ended up calling Martha's friends and just asking about her whereabouts. Now her friends would begin to search for her because they knew this wasn't normal behavior for Martha at all. Now, as any mum would do, Dorothy would wait up all night worrying about her, and the search would continue through most of the night without signs of Martha. Now, when Dorothy called the police department, it would initially be treated as a possible runaway. But upon the police actually talking with her friends and family, they'd begin a search at 4 a.m. because they knew that this was unusual for this little girl. Now, at around 10 a.m. on the morning of the 31st of October, Halloween, Mrs. Moxley, she'd end up calling the Skakel household and she'd ask Michael about Martha and if he knew where she was. She got very little back from him. Now, around midday of the same day, one of Martha's friends, Sheila Maguire, would find Martha's body behind a pine tree in her parents' backyard. Her pants and her underwear would be pulled down, but no signs of sexual assault were apparent. However, though, around her body would be three pieces of a broken six-iron golf club. Now, this would turn out to belong to the Mrs. Skakel. The following day, Dr. Elliot Cross, he'd conduct an autopsy, and the results were really, really horrible. Martha had been beaten and stabbed by that golf club. Now, here is what when I'm going to say something quite controversial, but it's not unheard of with this case. Was Martha's case only made famous by the affiliation with the Skakels, who happened to be related to the Kennedys? Or do we think that's why the police department would initially focus so hard on Tommy Skakel and then later on Michael? These are questions we're really never going to know the answers to, but I truly believe that this case would have been less known if it wasn't for the last person that had seen Martha were the Skakel boys. Now, the murder is clearly horrible in itself, and only more awful being that Martha's family, they don't have any justice for her, which makes it that much, much, much more sadder. But there is so much to cover before we go skipping to this ending. Now, a number of people were interviewed and questioned over the coming weeks after the murder. There were also a number of polygraphs. One of them happened to be Martha's neighbour, who was a suspect at the time, Ed Hammond. Now, he would thankfully pass and they would move on to interview more friends and family. Now, given that most accounts pointed to Tommy Skakel being the last person to see Martha, it would soon be discovered during the investigation that the six iron golf club we just talked about before would actually belong to a set of golf clubs owned by the late Mrs. Skakel. The most crucial part of this golf club was missing and never found. Now, this would be the handle of the golf club. So when you're whacking someone, if you can think about it, this is going to give you fingerprints and this is going to give you DNA and it's going to be able to identify your killer. So it's still out there, but I have a feeling, you know, it's never going to be found. The killer got rid of it that night so that he or she couldn't be identified. Tommy Skakel would be given two polygraphs, and the first results were inconclusive. And given that he was 17, this actually doesn't surprise me, okay? The amount of nerves that I would have at 17 taking a polygraph, I imagine my results would have been quite inconclusive. Now, the second, though, he did pass, though this definitely would not take him off the police's radar or the suspect pool. Now, in December 1975, the Greenwich Police Department, they'd end up searching the Skakels' Wyndham, New York residence with Rushton Skakel's permission. That happened to be the Skakels' brother's father, Rushton Skakel. Now, later that same month, they'd re-interview Tommy and get hair samples from him. Now, this is where it all gets to start being a little bit more interesting, because initially, Rushton would give permission to the police department to obtain Tommy's school, medical, and psychological records. Now, less than a week later, he would withdraw this permission and he would hire Manny Margolis as Tommy's criminal attorney. Now, Chris Roosevelt of the Whitby School, where Tommy attended school, would be quoted as saying, if Tommy were ever arrested, he would be defended by a battery of lawyers who would claim that boy was temporarily insane. Over the next 10 years or so, many, many, many people would try and solve this murder. Reward money would be posted, but no real leads could ever be identified. Now, at some point in the 90s, Rushton Skakel would hire a company by the name of Sutton Associates to investigate the murder and try and clear his boys' names. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, would this prove to be one of the biggest mistakes he ever made. Parts of this report would end up being leaked to a reporter and would reveal that there were three main suspects, Tommy and Michael Skakel and Ken Littleton, the live-in shooter at the Skakel residence at the time of Martha's murder. Now, I've got to say, guys, I've read parts of this Sutton report and it did not clear the Skakel's name at all. It really didn't. It brought up so many more questions. So now we're going to go through the list of those three suspects. First off, let's start with the elder Skakel, Tommy. He is, by all accounts, a really easy suspect to identify, right? He's the last person to be seen with Martha. He was fooling around with her. Maybe she said no to going further and he lost his temper. By the way, that is just a theory, but it is an easy assumption to make. Now, the Sutton report details out Tommy's mental capacity and issues, among other things. Now, Tommy's story of that night would change throughout the years. Now, when he was being interviewed by the Sutton Associates, he would originally say he didn't see Martha from 9:30 onwards, as he had a paper to write on Abraham Lincoln. Now, this would be proven to be a lie. The school would actually say he had no such report to write. He really didn't have the best reputation. He was known as angry, hot-tempered, and violent. But at other times, he'd be really nice and really quite charming. Now, a number of doctors would perform tests on Tommy to see if he was the raging psychopath who killed the lovely Martha. The changes to Tommy's whereabouts on the night of the murder would all be discovered during the investigation held by the Sutton Associates, where he was interviewed extensively. Now, one of the doctors that would conduct such tests and interviews would be Dr. Lessie. Now, this would be in 1976, and he would also end up producing a really, really thorough review on Tommy's prior medical and psychological records. Now, given that Dr. Lessie was retained by Rushton Skakel, he was given a lot more exposure and details of Tommy's childhood and behaviour. Now, as I mentioned before, Tommy would change his story a number of times. One story that he told investigators was that Martha was Michael's friends and he didn't spend more than 5 minutes with her. Now, another version was that she rejected him in the car and she was saying, no, 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 no. But later that same night, she'd make out with him. Side note for these listeners, Tommy was actually given sodium amytal, I believe it is, otherwise known as the truth serum. Now, when Dr. Lessie went to put the needle in, he flipped out. He was like, no, I don't want the needle, I don't want the needle. Now, and he wasn't sure whether he really wanted to take it. Now, do we think that was someone who was genuinely scared of the needle because that's what Dr. Lessie said it was? Or do we think he thought what went on that day was never provided to anyone else, as Dr. Lessie apparently never recorded it? I think he did, but he just never provided it to the Sutton Associates. However, I do have a quote of what Dr. Lessie recorded that day. Tommy was queried on a point-to-point basis as to the events that took place on the night of the 30th of October. The patient's response did not deviate from that which he had obtained by direct questioning when he was fully aware as they pertained to Martha Moxley's murder. Now, this confuses me as what he'd actually told the doctor was he'd never done anything sexual with Martha. Yet he would go on later to say that he and Martha made out for 30 minutes before she had to go home. I think the only thing we can rely on is that Tommy Skakel is either a bender of the truth or is he covering up for someone else? He would never actually end up being charged with her murder, but there is a part of me that believes he's involved somehow. I don't know if that's directly or indirectly. I'm just not sure. I feel like there's something more to that story. So now we're going to move on to Ken Littleton, who was also a part of Tommy's alibi, as after Tommy had come in after his little rendezvous with Martha, he'd end up watching French Connection with Ken. Now, Ken was a 23-year-old live-in tutor at the Skakel house, and the day of Martha's murder would actually end up being his first day. Now, he would also change parts of his story about that night, but he never changed the fact that he was always inside of the house. Never changed. it would just be like time references and differences in how long Tommy stayed with him and stuff like that. Now, I think this night would change Ken forever. And some might say that it started a spiral that never really stopped. Now, at the time of Martha's murder, he was also a teacher at the Brunswick Academy, where some of the Skakel boys attended school. And that's actually how he came to be their live-in tutor. Now, shortly after this murder, he would lose his job at the Skakel house due to a dispute over some pay. And this would be followed by also him losing his job at the Brunswick Academy. Now, I have no doubt that the reason for losing his teaching job was due to being a suspect in a young girl's murder. Now, he would try and avoid the scrutiny and the police by moving to Nantucket just to try and start afresh. This would really prove to be futile as those investigators would come to his new teaching job, and that would lead to another job loss. Around about this same time, though, Ken had started to drink heavily, and this is when his life would begin a downward spiral. In the summer of 76, he'd be arrested for grand larceny, breaking and entering, and burglary. Now, all of these things and charges he'd actually do while he was under the influence. Now, he'd continue to do petty crimes and sometimes worse, ranging from shoplifting to assault and battery. So it is recorded, though, that all the times that he was doing these illegal activities, he was always under the influence of either alcohol or drugs. So the Sutton Report would actually interview Ken about the night of the murder, but given his issues with alcohol, his downward spiral and psychological concerns, they actually believed he was hiding something and possibly lying to save himself. But Ken would allude to Michael, little brother Michael, being more of the problem child rather than Tommy. He would say that Michael was a violent individual with not only a drug but an alcohol problem, but he was also sadistic. He liked to kill squirrels and other animals with golf clubs. That's a little concerning for me, considering Martha was killed by a golf club. Now, the Greenwich police, they did their best to get the evidence, but it just really wasn't there. It wasn't there that Ken had done it. During a documentary I watched about Martha's murder, Ken's ex-wife, Mary, discussed their failed marriage and his drug and his alcohol abuse, but she truly believed he didn't commit the murder, despite during his drug and alcohol abuse, he'd become at times combative, rude, and resentful. Now, I tend to agree here because the only reason he developed these problems was because of the murder. He'd never had a previous history of doing anything like this. So it almost makes me wonder, what did you witness that night or what did you contribute to? Now, the same would be said from John Moxley, Martha's brother. He'd actually go and confront Ken about his involvement. And Ken openly wept and was genuinely upset about John and his family losing Martha. Now, John felt that Ken's life was ruined as a result of being a suspect and being associated with that night at all. And it sounds like a pretty sad story at the end of the day for Ken. So did he witness something? Did he know a bit more? We'll never know. Last, and certainly by no means least, we're going to get on to Michael Skakel. Now, Michael, who was 5th, initially not even on the police's radar as a suspect. He had a really strong alibi. He'd gone over to his cousin's house and watched the Monty Python movie, and he wasn't home during the alleged time of the murder. It was said to have been between 9:30 and 10:30, a time that would actually come under scrutiny at the time of the trial. Now, he got home just after 11-ish. Seems like a pretty easy assumption, right? To think that he had nothing to do with it. But over the next 20 years, lies would begin to unravel that would put Michael right in the forefront of the police. Michael, he was definitely known as the troublesome one of the family, and it's been reported that he was an alcoholic by the age of 13. Though I would really like to give a little bit of an insight into the Skakel family before we continue. Mrs. Skakel had passed away in 1972, and Michael was just 12, and his father really didn't handle this situation well at all. He would end up working around the clock, and he was known to be drunk most of the other times. So the children effectively, they're left to raise themselves or have the older siblings in charge when they were barely old enough themselves. Given that Michael had already had emotional problems before his mother's death, I would say that after her death, those problems probably multiplied. In 1978, this had proved to be a really crabby and crummy year for Michael, and it would be where things start to crumble a little bit. He was arrested for a DUI, he's barely even 18, and a deal was worked out between Michael's lawyer and the prosecutors that charges would be dropped if he would commit himself for observation for 6 months. Now, he would attend a school called Ellen, E-L-A-N, and you're going to want to remember that name, guys, Ellen. A prep school for people with emotional, behavioural and drug problems. Now, for the next 10 years, Michael would be in and out of rehab centres. Now, while at one of them in Maryland, he would supposedly tell a roommate, something happened back home and the police are involved. Since then, I've been in and out of a lot of these facilities. The police want to talk to me, so my family keeps moving me from one place to another because the police can't track you down. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, because it could be someone wanting their 5 minutes of fame for being Michael Gaykel's roommate, or this could be something quite genuine. Now, the famous Sutton report that was leaked would also prove to be the undoing for Michael. And I definitely don't think when Rushton asked them to investigate that this is what he'd had expected by any stretch of the imagination. Now, the changes to Michael's alibi were discussed during interviews in the Allen School. Something, again, that I would suspect is a slight mixture of truth and lie. And then it would be discussed even further with the Sutton Associates. It was about when he got home from his cousin's house. Now, it's been said that he didn't actually go to his cousin's house that night, but we don't have any strong evidence that marks that as true. Now, after he got home, he allegedly climbed a tree to look at a neighbour who walked around naked. Now, to me, that does sound like something that a rebellious teenage boy would do, but apparently the lady decided not to actually do that night. So he decided to climb to another tree and to see if Martha was awake. Now, he would throw pebbles at her window, but she wasn't awake or there. Now, the next part is a little peculiar to me. He said that he masturbated in the tree. And now, a little bit I did forget to mention is that apparently Michael did have a bit of a crush on Martha Moxley. So this could explain the need to relieve himself. Now, he would say once he was finished, he would climb another tree at his own house and get into his bedroom. One thing that I find a little bit odd about this story in particular is, why would you need to climb a tree to get into your own home? Like, seriously, wouldn't you just go through one of the doors? Now, I alluded to before that the changes to the times of the death. Now, what that means is, when we went to trial, it was found that actually she had been murdered somewhere between 9:30 and 12. So that threw Michael's alibi out, okay? So just so everybody is aware. Now, with these changes to his alibi and given his mental health issues, he did actually become really quickly the main suspect for Martha's murder. But his brother Tommy was still on the radar. Now, let's move on to the arrest and how that led to the trial and all the events that occurred after this. In 1994, Frank Garr, who'd previously worked as an investigator in Martha's case for the Greenwich Police Department, he started work at the state's attorney's office, and he would end up working full-time on Martha's case due to a lot of pressure from the Moxley family and the community really wanting answers about what had happened to this girl. So almost 4 years later, in 1998, the prosecutors would convince the Connecticut court to invoke the state's rarely used grand jury process. Now, Connecticut doesn't use citizen panels like other states do, but rather they appoint a grand juror. Now, he's usually a retired, this person is usually a retired judge, to investigate a crime if all other avenues have been exhausted. Now, what it makes this so interesting is the grand juror can compel witnesses to give interviews, but that's something that prosecutors cannot do. Now, ultimately, this grand juror can recommend to lay charges. Now, Superior Court Judge George Tim, he'd end up being appointed. Now, over the course of this process, over 40 witnesses, including Dorothy and John Moxley, the friends that were with Martha that night, and even a begrudging Rushton Skakel, he tried numerous times to get out of it. Things like he's got a senile, he's mentally incapable. He had to give evidence in the end. Now, perhaps the most damning evidence would be from the witnesses of the Allen School. Remember that school he was ordered to go to after his DUI? Some of them claimed that Michael Skakel had made admissions to the murder of Martha Moxley. Now, these testimonies were heard behind closed doors, and there would also be a testimony from Ken Littleton about that night. Now, he'd be granted immunity from the prosecution team. I've got to ask, and like I've researched it and everything like that, but I don't know what he was granted immunity from. I'd really, really like to know. Now, in December 1999, the grand juror investigation would end after about 18 months, and he would be given 60 days to decide if there was enough probable cause for an arrest. Now, in January 2000, so it's 25 years, guys, 25 years after the murder, the prosecution said that they had an arrest warrant for an unnamed juvenile. Now, given that Michael was 15 at the time of the murder, I imagine that's why he isn't named and he's also being charged as a juvenile. Now, Michael Skakel would end up surrendering himself later that day and his family would post the $500,000 bail and he would be free. Wouldn't it be nice to like be able to post $500,000 worth of bail, by the way, guys? Like, he just has that kind of money. Now, here's some of those twists and turns I was talking about and some really interesting parts. One of them was whether to charge Michael as an adult or a juvenile. Now, this would take some time to decide in the court system, and it would be inevitably be decided to transfer to the adult or criminal court in January 2001. However, though, in the year 2000, all the hearings that they'd already been held in the juvenile court. But during that time, the state attorney said he wanted to move it from the juvenile court to the criminal court. And given the amount of violence that was inflicted upon Martha, I imagine that even if the murder happened today, that a prosecutor would request this to be moved to a criminal court. Now, even before the trial had begun, there was huge amounts of tension as there were witnesses from both sides saying really conflicting information. The prosecution itself, they had two witnesses from the Allen School claiming that Michael had confessed to the murder, whereas the defence had three witnesses from the same school saying that despite numerous attempts to get Michael to confess, even beatings, he never did. So that's some really conflicting information. So sorry, I did derail a little bit there. But let's get back to why he was charged as an adult. The judge, Maureen Davis, reviewed the request to try him as an adult and actually said the following. Under the state law, a juvenile found delinquent can be committed to a state youth facility or hospital or other institution, but state facilities cannot accept anyone over the age of 18, and a commitment to a mental institution would not be appropriate for this case. The court further finds that the facilities of the Adult Criminal Division of the Superior Court afford and provide a more effective setting for the disposition of this case. So basically, if he was found guilty, no juvenile facility could hold him, and it's far more appropriate for it to be held in a criminal court rather than a juvenile court. Look, it makes sense to me. Like, if he's convicted, where are you going to put him, like, in a juvenile facility? Like, where are you going to put him? She's saying we can't put him anywhere. We can't put him in a state facility. We can't put him in a mental institution. Like, what are we going to do? And the best course of action would be play this out in the criminal court. Now, given that all the pre-trial proceedings, they'd already been held in juvenile court, these would now need to be heard in criminal court as well. So that further delays a trial start date. But there would be a need to hold what's called a probable cause hearing, which determines if there's enough evidence for it to proceed to trial. Now, there would be motions about the venues, whether it should be held, where it should be held. So whether it be held where it should have been if it was 1975, which was Bridgeport. Now, the jury pool in this area would be better in the air. It would be better for a conviction, in my opinion, as this area had a little bit more working class and they wouldn't like the Skakels tied to the Kennedys or money. Whereas the other venue, Stamford, which actually only started hearing criminal cases in 1981, would be an area where they would sympathise with the Skakel family and relate to that wealth and power. Now, in the end, it was decided to be held in Bridgeport. Another motion that would be denied is to dismiss the charges based on a statute of limitations. And also during this period, a key witness for the prosecution would die. His name is Gregory Coleman. Now, Michael's attorney, Mickey Sherman, tried to do his best, and he did put forward what I think are at points some really valid arguments. One in particular would be Gregory Coleman. Now, he's a prosecution witness. Now, he ended up being a guard for Michael during his time at Ellen. And Michael had attempted to escape, so he required supervision with a guard as a result. Now, he testified at the grand jury as well as the probable cause hearing. Now, he would admit that he took the drug heroin before the grand jury testimony, and that's why his story didn't match up to what he actually testified in the probable cause hearing. Now, he would die before the trial began. So Mickey would appeal that the transcript of the testimony would hinder Michael's right to a fair trial. He did put up a good argument. You can't cross-examine someone who's not dead, right? But this is where he lost credibility to this. He'd already done cross-examination during the probable cause hearing. So that testimony would end up being read. So he really lost his footing and his grounding on that one. Now, the prosecution, in my opinion, just my opinion, had a really weak amount of evidence, and they relied heavily on witnesses and a lot of circumstantial evidence. And don't get me wrong, that's not me saying I don't believe what the witnesses have said. I just don't think it was a particularly strong case. Though I do truly believe something is amiss with the Skakel family. Now, some of the most damning evidence is things that it was well known that Michael had a crush on Martha and was jealous of perhaps the tryst between her and Tommy. Now, this is me just speculating here. But what would happen if Michael had tried his hand with Martha that night and she'd rejected him? Now, did he get so angry at the thought of him, like her, messing around with his brother but not him, that he'd end up beating her with a golf club and finished it off by stabbing her? Now, it's not unheard of, right? Because he's already done this to squirrels and little animals. So it certainly suggested that this was a murder of passion. Now, given the rivalry between Tommy and Michael, it does seem plausible. It's not an unlikely reason to kill a person, and we've certainly seen and heard dumber reasons for people being murdered. Now, it would take just over a month for the trial to end, and in June 2002, Michael Skakel would be found guilty of the murder and he'd be sentenced to 20 years in jail. Now, this wouldn't, unfortunately, this just wouldn't be the end. He'd raise many appeals to the state and federal courts. He had the money to do so, and he's really, really lucky that he had the ability to do this. Now, in 2013, Judge Thomas Bishop of the Tolland Superior Court, he'd end up vacating the conviction and order a new trial. Now, the reason behind this would be that Mickey Sherman had provided inadequate counsel and failed to effectively present Michael. Now, Michael ended up being released on a bail of $1 million, I think it was. I think it was somewhere around that. Now, in 2016, the Connecticut court actually reversed the decision to vacate. But unfortunately, it would be reversed again in 2018, and that would leave Michael a free man still. In October 2020, the prosecutors advised that they don't have enough evidence to try Michael again. And honestly, I'm not really surprised at this, guys. It was a pretty weak circumstantial case in the first place. So what's to say that they've got enough evidence today? There's not enough DNA. They don't have fingerprints. Like, it's just the only real person really that's failed is Martha and her family. And I really hope one day they can find justice for her. But Dorothy did say, Dorothy Moxley, she did say Michael was convicted. He went to jail. So for her, he was found guilty. And she still truly believes that Michael is actually guilty. Anyway, guys, I really hope you've enjoyed the bonus episode. Hit the subscribe or follow button if you like this podcast. And again, feel free to leave comments. Now, until the next one, peanuts, enjoy.